so we're just going to learn tonight in memory of Ellen's mother. It was Sarah bat Moshe Vizlata. She was Sarah Kane in English. And it's how many years since this?
10 years. You're exactly. Ten,
okay, 10 years. So the learning should be in her memory. And there's a chut for the whole family and for all of Klal Yisrael. The topic tonight is one of the leitmotifs of Sefer Mishlei and one of the major themes of the 18th parak in particular, which is silence, and in particular silence which is to be utilized for the purpose of deliberation, that is to say thinking thoroughly through something and or listening. And as we move through just a number of the psukim which I selected as highlights, and then through some Mamare Chazal, and as we move forward, hopefully this will become clear. So just to jump right into the psukim, this is the second pasuk in the perek. The pasuk says as follows: Lo yachpots kesil bitvuna ki'im bihit galot libo. The fool does not actually desire wisdom, but rather to recite his own thoughts. Again, lo yachpots kesil bitzvuna. We're just in the first source. The fool doesn't actually seek wisdom, but what he's interested in is, sort of projecting, pontificating, glorifying himself by spreading his pearls of wisdom, or at least what he considers to be his wisdom. But he never slows down enough to listen, to think, to grow in wisdom. So again, the parak really does begin on this note, portraying the ksil, who's the opposite of the chacham, which is obviously what we aspire to. The ksil is somebody who doesn't pause and who's always too busy talking and sharing.
Ksil, what's the literal translation?
A fool. To ever listen. Going forward, this is the 13th pasuk of the parak. Meshiv davar b'tara mishma, somebody who answers before they actually fully hear out the other person. Ivelat hilo uchlima. So it's a folly for him, meaning he'll never really respond to the point. And chlima, it's shameful, it's embarrassing. This is I don't actually know if they score it this way, but you know how in Jeopardy you're allowed to buzz in even while Trebek is still reading the question. Right, they don't penalize you more if you get it wrong, but they should. Mishlei would. It's not a moral counting, but it should be. So, in other words, this is really the lowest. The Gemara in Bava Basra, Adaf Tzadiches, speaks very, very negatively about this kind of behavior. The Gemara is going through like the lowest forms of human interaction. So, on the list. It's an interesting list. So just some of the highlights are a guest who brings another guest with him. In other words, I mean, it's one thing if you ask. That's obviously fine. We couldn't have the West Side without it. But if you show up at somebody's house as a guest, it's really not appropriate without consulting the host to bring more guests, as the Gemara Basra is talking about. And then the Gemara basically asks, is there anybody lower than that? And then the Gemara says, yes. And it quotes this pasuk, Meshiv davar b'tera mishma. Somebody who's not even willing to listen, and he's already giving answers, right? Because how are you ever going to be able to address, no matter how smart and perceptive you think you are, how are you ever going to be able to address the actual question or the point at hand if you're not willing to hear the person out? This is a topic to which we'll return. But again, just as the parak started with, it's a bad thing if somebody is always pontificating, never slows down enough to actually gain wisdom, but is always just sort of sharing what's on their mind in a self-absorbed kind of way. So too, cutting somebody else off, not letting them finish their thought, is another thing which the Sefer Mishlei is objecting to. Now, in contrast to these forms of behavior, the 15th pasuk in the parak, Lev Navon, the discerning heart, Yikne Da'as, that one will acquire wisdom. Ve'ozen Chachamim, Tevakesh Da'as, and the ear of the wise seeks knowledge. So, it's not a coincidence that the chacham is being described with which part of the body? The ozen, right? That the chacham and the ozen are inextricably linked. The chacham is in some measure defined by his willingness and his capacity to listen intently and meaningfully. And this is really the first, what I would call the first gift of silence, just before we move forward, which is that the first gift of silence is really to become a chacham. Think about all the things that if one is willing to take the time and maybe humble enough to realize that one doesn't know everything just simply by being here, by being born. The first gift of silence is that it affords one the opportunity to actually listen and to maximize. There's a lot of good things out there, and by a person not having the need to project themselves all the time, that's where we started. The kasiel is he's galos libo, he's just revealing and reciting his own thoughts. If a person can hold himself back from that, the rewards can be very high. Of course, in the opposite direction, a person who's always just busy, you know, on the proverbial speaking or lecture circuit. So when does he ever have time to study? Literally, when does he ever have time to grow in wisdom, etc.? So that's exactly what Sefer Mishlei is pointing out. Okay, let me just take a stop here and let's gather some questions, comments, reactions. Just before we take a look, expand our discussion beyond Sefer Mishlei. Don, yeah, no, go ahead.
It's,
oh, okay.
It's almost common sense in terms
100%.
Of gateways without halakhic thing, but almost in a secular sense of understanding how one learns.
Yeah.
And grows.
Yeah, there's no way. There's literally no way. I mean, unless one, you know, is endowed with some kind of prophetic revelation, right? There'd be literally no other way to acquire information than from the outside. If one takes a step back and think about that, that's really one of the most beautiful things about our existence here, is that God designed the world such that the only way that we could actually grow is by opening ourselves up to things that are outside of ourselves. There's a metaphor there, right, about what it means to be here. Ellen.
Well, I think it's also, you know, that listening is an active state.
Okay, excellent. So what Ellen is already alluding to is what I would call the second gift of silence. The first gift, gift of learning how to be silent and how to use silence productively is what it can do for oneself. What Ellen is already pointing out is that it can actually do a lot for other people, meaning that if one listens intently, not, you know, to use a cliche, but it's really true, not just waiting one's turn to speak, but actually listening carefully, the level of insight that one can have into other people, and then the extent to which a person can respond to them and respond to their needs. We're going to see the classical example of this. The extent to which one can do that is completely in proportion with one's listening. Ellie.
I was going to say very something good. Similar. It's actually passive and active listening. You know, some people just kind of listen, and then there's active listening where you bring yourself in without contributing. What I'm wondering, and I don't want to preempt anything, is how do we get people to do this? This is what's wrong with our society today.
Right. Right.
I mean, our television, our whole society is about, I need to be out there, I need to be saying things. Don't listen to anyone.
Right. That's actually
I mean, in terms of, I'm talking about the community.
Yeah, yeah, 100%.
The Torah, I mean, Mishlei is very nice, but how do we get people to know that it, you know, that right. This is a rule for the road?
Yeah. We're gonna end 5 minutes early. I guess we'll take suggestions. that I consider beyond my unfortunately beyond my purview. But no.
Just something to
right.
think about.
Yeah, no, 100%. I mean, look, you know, hopefully being exposed to the ideas in a concentrated way, which is why I picked the topic, you know, is somewhat helpful. But Ellie's point is very, very well taken. Mishlei knew just how aspirational this was. Shlomo was no fool, and you know he, as we'll try to show from his own life, he took this very seriously. So when we get to the psukim that we're going to read from Sefer Melachim, I think this will speak somewhat to your issue. But I just recognize it's a very good question. It's a very good question, and one that I'll have to admit from the beginning. You know, if I had the answer to that, I guess I could, you know. Yeah, there you go.
I want to drink
right.
first though.
Right, exactly. I could be one of those gurus, you know, who goes around and like, you know, I have the whatever. Okay, so
I just think we're all guilty of it.
Yeah, 100%. Well, what Ollie's really pointing out is that this requires a massive amount of emotional energy to listen actively, right? If it were easy, we wouldn't need to learn about it. It's just so much easier to you know, inertia, you know, and go basically to do what we normally do. So it does require a tremendous amount of focus and effort, that's for sure. So one of the interesting things, I just did a little bit of an experiment this afternoon in preparation. I went through all of Pirkei Avos just to see, because it's a leitmotif throughout Chazal, this idea of listening. And there's just so many Mishnayos in Pirkei Avos which speak to this exact point. I just picked out what to me are the highlights. I wanted to go through them together, which just underscore how it wasn't just Shlomo and Mishle, but Chazal after Shlomo really saw this ability to be deliberate, to be able to consider things, not to react right away, absolutely central to both the acquisition of knowledge and to the development of the religious personality. Both of those things, which are distinct. Again, accessing knowledge generally, that's what Don was saying before, is it's true of every form of wisdom. You know, Dr. Holtzman could tell us about that in cardiology, right? If you're not willing to listen to the attendings then how could you learn anything about the, you know, right ventricle? You wouldn't learn anything about it. But so it's true generally in life, but it's specifically true when it comes to the cultivation of a religious personality. So if you take a look, this is the very first Mishnah in Pirkei Avos, a famous Mishnah. Moshe kibel Torah miSinai, umisara liYoshua, and Moshe passed it on to Yoshua, the word being Mesorah. This is the beginning of the Mesorah. Yehoshua lezakenim, uzakenim leNeviim, Neviim misaru al anshe Knesset Hagadola, the men of the great assembly. Heimam Rushlosha Dvarim, and they taught three things. This is the very beginning of Pirkei Avos. I'm not interested in the latter two for now. The first of which was Hevu Misunim Badin. Be deliberate in judgment. And that's before anything else. The first thing that we have in Pirkei Avos, like the first Pirkei, you don't get a more basic document in terms of a Jewish outlook than Pirkei Avos. And the first teaching in Pirkei Avos is Hevu Misunim Badin. Wait. Just slow down. Think it through. There's an amazing statement in its own right about the centrality of deliberation, poise, carefully considering things. Again, the specific context is din when you're in judgment, but in the courtroom setting. But we're always in one process of din or another. It's just the din, what I like to call the din of life. You know, it doesn't actually have to be a judicial proceeding, but we're always making decisions, right? So hevu mesunim badin, be thoughtful and deliberate in judgment. Don't rush to conclusions. Don't rush to vocalize those conclusions. Take your time. Not only that, but going forward, just in the second parak now, this is from Hillel. Hillel Haya Omer, Marbe Yeshiva, Marbe Chachma. The one who's Marbe Be Yeshiva. Yeshiva is used to sit, but it's much more than sitting. Those who our marbe yeshiva will be marbe chachma. The way that I know it doesn't just mean to sit is nobody ever said, or it's inconceivable that if a person says, well, I sat on my couch 16 hours today and I didn't get anything out of it, right? It's because yeshiva in this context doesn't mean to be in the sitting position, right? One could be in a sitting position for an extended period of time and not necessarily be marbe chachma. So yeshiva in this context, it really means thoughtful, deliberation. It's the same word in German. In German, they say, Sitzfleisch. You have to be able to be able to sit through something to really think it through. So again, a person who's willing to engage in what I call studious contemplation, the language of the Mishnah is yeshiva. That itself is the key to being marbe and chachma, developing one's wisdom and adding to one's wisdom. There is no adding to one's wisdom in an ad hoc kind of way. It requires marbe yeshiva, sitting down and really thinking things through, not reacting right away, but as the first Mishnah itself said, hevu misunim badin. Moreover, if you take a look at source 4, these are like all the giants, Anshei Knesset Hagadola, we had Hillel, Rabbi Akiva now. If Hillel's not enough, we have Rabbi Akiva. Rabbi Akiva Omer, Siag lechachma shesika. Silence is a fence for wisdom. So, anybody want to jump in with a perush for the Mishnah? Siag lechachma shesika. Silence is a fence for wisdom.
It's just a fence keeps things in. that the offense keeps the wisdom from running away, or it keeps you from going beyond boundaries, you know, to do things that may not be wisdom. I don't know, it's just...
Okay, okay, good, good, good. And can we get any other volunteers? Dana? You're quiet back there. No? Okay. Dana's choosing silence, which we know is a...
She's reflecting.
She's internalizing, which is good. Which is good. So what might Rabbi Akiva mean? It's a bit of a cryptic statement. Siag l'chachma shesika, right? Silence is a fence for wisdom.
Something that I
yeah,
always saw...
Rivka, sure.
I always saw that basically as listen, as like something happens, and the smartest thing to do is just be quiet, listen, understand what's going on, then respond. Wait.
Excellent.
So that's how I was. Yeah.
Okay, I completely agree. I think that's exactly what Rabbi Akiva had in mind. In other words, if one is acculturated or regulated oneself to respond right away to something, the chances that one will come up with the best response are reduced. Right, you're just reacting, and sometimes instinctive reactions are good too, but the more one thinks something through, again, this is consistent with what Hillel said before, mar be yeshiva, mar be chachma, the more one is willing to actually sit and think through a problem, an issue that one is confronting, the more likely the result is going to be one of chachma. If one is shooting from the hip, you know, it's not going to be a great surprise if one ends up regretting at least part of what one said, right? That's just the nature of things. We don't always have the best instinctive or intuitive responses. Yeah, Maren.
I'm just offense is
siyag. Siyag, yeah. Siyag okay. Literally means it. Like in the first teaching also of Pirkei Avos, the ones we didn't get into, it says, Hevu mesunim badin and ha midu talmidim harbe. You should raise many students. And the most famous use of siyag, asu siyag la Torah. You have to build a fence around the Torah. So okay. Classical example of that would be is that if the Torah said that certain kinds of things are prohibited, so then the chachamim would come and make sure that one didn't get into a situation where one would be tested, you know, put in a very difficult situation. So siyag means a kind of fence or protection.
Okay.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah, that's a very very important term for the Mishnah. Okay, the Mishnah which speaks about this concept arguably most explicitly is actually towards the end of Pirkei Avos, Perek He. There's so much in the first four prakim we hardly ever get there, but it's actually a beautiful Mishnah. Yeah. Oh, was there?
No. Oh. I just
read it. Okay. Excellent.
I agree.
Shiva dvarim begolam v'shiva bechacham. There are seven things which are characteristic, typological of a wise person, and seven things for a golem. Now, a golem here is not a reference to, you know, the medieval Renaissance era golem. You know, the Jewish Frankenstein, as it were. But actually, the way the Rambam defines. Sorry, go ahead. Yeah, exactly. So what the Rambam says is golem is basically somebody who has certain features, and you can see where the etymology is, certain good features, certain good qualities and characteristics, but he's unrefined. He hasn't really gotten quite there yet. He's missing something, right? That becomes very easily translated then into a golem, right? A person who has, you know, like the physical wherewithal is the physical parts, but not necessarily, right, the spirit, the soul, the brain, whatever he's missing in that case. So, again, there's the Mishnah is drawing a contrast between the chacham, the typological chacham, and the golem, the person who isn't there. And there are seven differences. So what is characteristic of a chacham? It's just such a striking list. Right, you know, this is again almost an obsession for Chazal. Chazal are always asking, "Ezehu chacham?" You know, "Halo made me call Adam." "Ezehu chacham?" You know, the person who's able to learn from everybody. "Ezehu chacham haroes hanola?" The person who's able to anticipate. So again, Chazal are just totally preoccupied with not just the act of studying, but this is just an important meta point. Just take a step back. You could study about anything, right? You could study about the laws of Hanukkah. You could study laws about Pesach. You could study the laws of Davening. But one of Chazal's main areas of study, one of the things they were most interested in learning about, was the act of learning itself. Okay? They were just totally intrigued by that. And it was seeking wisdom about wisdom. Okay, that was something that really preoccupied them. So this Mishnah is in that genre. Say, what's characteristic of a Chacham? Seven things. Number one, Enu medaber bifnei misha hu gadol mimenu bechachma. So he has reverence. He doesn't speak in front of somebody who is greater than him in terms of chachma. It's, again, this self-control. He's not impulsive in his speech. He knows when to be silent and how to be silent. Because, you know, as Ellie would point out, she just said, you know, the person who is able to stay silent in front of somebody who is, you know, greater wisdom, that person is now going to be in a wonderful position to become a chacham, to learn in his own right. So there's a kind of reverence here which has really important and helpful ramifications. Number one. Number two, Eino nichnas letoch divrei chavero. Anybody know what that means exactly? Eino nichnas, he doesn't enter into the words of his friends, which means he does not excellent. He does not interrupt. He's patient. Again, even if he's fairly certain what he's going to respond, there's a kind of patience there, and make sure that you've correctly and accurately heard exactly what the person said. I mean, how much time is wasted every day all across the world by people interrupting each other and then figuring out that if they just, you know, listened to the end of the sentence, right, they would have saved that whole circle or triple circle or whatever, you know. Sometimes it never gets resolved, right? So, Eino nichnas letoch divrei chavero, again, characteristic of the chacham. All these things have to do with speech and silence and controlling those two, balancing properly those two faculties. Number three, Eino nivhal lahashiv. He does not rush to answer. Poise. He can stay within himself for a certain amount of time to properly formulate a response. Sho'il ke'inyan. He asks relevant questions. The Chacham asks relevant questions. Umeshiv kahalacha. And when asked a question, he responds to the point. But in here, the contrast again is with somebody who's asking not for the sake of asking to the point, but as, you know, we've all been to events, and then you get to the question section. And the first chiddush is, if it's a question in its own right, usually it's not even a question. Usually it's a mini speech until, you know, the groaning gets audible. But even the person's willing to ask a question, right? It's oftentimes, this is just unfortunate but true, right? The person is asking to ask to hear themselves talk. So the Mishnah is saying the definition of a chacham is shoal ke'inyan. He's asking relevant questions, thoughtful questions. And in the opposite situation, meishiv kahalacha, right? At those same events, you know, when those questions get asked, more often than not, you know, the person who's responding will just respond to whatever he wants to respond. Watch any debate, right? They ask the question, hey, a person just say, it's like giving a speech, right? It's like the question never happened, right? So the Chachamim weren't thrilled with it. I mean, it existed, right? They weren't thrilled with that mode of interaction. So again, Shoel ki'inyan meshiv kalacha. Not just speaking for the sake of speaking, but being to the point, being relevant. Omer al rishon rishon ve'al acharon acharon, organizing one's response. First things first and last things last. By the way, anybody know who Chazal applied this to? Chazal were very impressed when somebody did this. This is part of the impression that Rivka makes when Eliezer Eved Avraham, or the Eved, Chazal say it was Eliezer, when he encounters the when he encounters Rivka, he asks her a number of questions. Including, who are you, and do you have a place for us to stay? And she answers in order of the questions that were presented. And Rashi just quotes from Chazal there, and he says, "Mishiva al rishon rishon ve'al achron achron." Quoting from this Mishnah, right? That she answered the first question first and the second question second, which meant that she, you know, was organized and going to be efficient, as my grandmother would like to say, efficient. That's always the geruten in Yiddish. Yeah, yeah, that, exactly. Ellie, very good point. Ellie just made a point just now. Ellie was saying, and that she actually listened to the questions. Right, that was right. That's implicit. Very true. Okay. Then the last two qualities, the almashalo shama. So the Mishnah Pirkei Avos says the chacham is characterized by Almasha lo shama, when he hasn't heard something, he doesn't know something, Omer lo shamati. He has the integrity to say, you know, I haven't.
You don't know?
Yeah. I don't know. That reminds me, when I was. So after my first year of of college, so I had a research job at Sloan Kettering. So that's what I thought I was going to do, and whatever. So they let me go on rounds every morning at 7 a.m. or whatever. So one of the most brutal things I saw was the doctor who's leading the rounds, and there's like residents, and then there's just me because I'm 19 and hanging out there for the summer and whatever. So just listening. So the doctor asked some question. Peppering all the residents with questions as they go from room to room. And this resident who obviously wants to try and impress, difficult situation to be in, the guy asked some question to which he felt there was no answer. And she made up an answer. And he started attacking her. He said, that question has no answer, et cetera, et cetera. So I thought, what kind of person does that? That's a sick, nasty thing to do. But in any event, from her standpoint, right, she would have been better off just saying, as Chazal say here, "Amash lo shama, Omer lo shamati." If a person doesn't know, it's always a better policy to say, "I don't know." I'm not saying that what he did was okay. I thought he came out looking much worse than she did, from my standpoint. Anyway, though nobody asked me, of course. But that's what Chazal are talking about. "Amash lo shama, Omer lo shamati." Do we have any verification of that? In the that's never happened. That kind of incident.
In any form.
Right, exactly. So then the final criterion in the Mishnah is
Socrates is like, "I know, I know not," right?
Right. Right, that would have been better. So the final criterion in the Mishnah is Umoda al ha'emes, the intellectual honesty to say when a person is wrong, just to say that I'm wrong, you're right. Right. All these things are characteristic of Chacham, of the wise person. Now, so many of them, as we saw, really have to do with the person having the self-control, not just to say whatever comes to mind, to be silent, whether it's in the presence of somebody who's more learned they are, and not to interrupt, not to rush to answer, not to ask questions just to be heard, and not to answer in a way that's not relevant to the question, etc., etc., etc. So many of these things really, again, speak to our basic point, which is the interrelationship between productive silence which is useful, and wisdom, using silence as a way of learning and absorbing, so that one can grow in one's wisdom, that one can ultimately be transformed by silence itself. Silence is a gift if one utilizes it to exalt oneself and to transform oneself by absorbing important information. Just to conclude, this is from the last parak in Pirkei Avos, a further Mishnah. We've spoken about this Mishnah in the past. HaTorah nikneis ba'arbayim u'shmona dvarim. Torah is acquired in 48 different ways with 48 different skills, and the first one is Talmud, study itself. But then the four of them, I just culled four from the list, have to do with precisely this point: listening and contemplating and deliberating. Bishmias ha'ozen, a listening ear. Binas ha'lev, discernment of the heart. Sichlos ha'lev, wisdom of the heart. And yishuv, again, hearkening back to what we saw previously, mar be yeshiva, mar be chachma, that it's impossible to acquire wisdom without shmias ha'ozen, without careful listening. Binas ha'lev and sichlos ha'lev, reflecting upon that which one has learned, right? Taking the time not just to, again, this means after the lecture or whatever it is, after the shiur, sitting and processing and integrating and internalizing that whole process, and then yishuv and sitting and thinking it through and working it out. This is all so essential to the act of learning in terms of growing in wisdom. So what we've seen so far is, again, say for Mishlei, speaking to these concepts, Pirkei Avos, speaking about them at such great length. But what I thought we would do in the second half of this year is to just illustrate just how important this was to Shlomo on a personal level. Shlomo, of course, being the author of Sefer Mishlei, to just bring Shlomo's actual life into the discussion. And in the spirit of listening and learning from others, this is something I first heard from a teacher of mine, my teacher for 4 years in high school, Rabbi Yitzchak Tursky, who lives in Neve Daniel now. Actually, just down the block from Rabbi Berman, literally. So whenever I go to Israel, I'm able to visit both of them, usually back to back, which is always nice for me that they organized it that way. But who I'm incredibly indebted to my Rabbi, Rav Tursky, who's just a giant of learning. If anybody's interested, by the way, in having access to him, He published a number of svarim recently called Amita Shel Torah, which is his Perush on Chumash. It's really a beautiful and very deep work of Torah, and he has many svarim that are forthcoming. This is something that I always remembered so fondly from what he taught us in high school, something that I wanted to share. It's really a story about Shlomo's life. Shlomo wasn't just writing in Mishlei about the importance of silence and learning how to listen effectively in the abstract, but this is something that was truly near and dear to his heart. So if you take a look at, this is all from the third parak of Sefer Melachim, the Navi says as follows. Vayehav Shlomo et Adonai. It's an amazing expression in its own right, that Shlomo, this is on, just on the third page, Shlomo loved God. That's like a very, you don't find too many times in Tanakh. Avram Avinu is described as an Ohev Hashem, but how many people can we think of are described as an Ohev Hashem? That's itself a striking. Moshe Rabbeinu is never described as an Ohev Hashem. He's described as an Oved Hashem, as an Eved Hashem, and other. But again, as an Ohev Hashem, that itself is a very singular description. Vayehav Shlomo et Adonai, v'alechet b'chukot David Aviv, to follow in the ways of his father David. Rak babamot hu mizabeach hu maktir, right? The only thing that he did, which maybe wasn't ideal, was offer sacrifices on the bamot. Bamot being private altars. Vayilech hamelech givon lizboach sham. So the king Shlomo went to Givon, a city which is of great significance in Tanakh, to offer korbanos there. Kihi habama hagdola. That was the greatest of all private altars. Elef olot ya'ale Shlomo al mizbeach ahu. Shlomo would offer no fewer than 1,000 korbanos on that altar. Bigivon nira Adonai el Shlomo b'chalom halayla. So God appeared in a nighttime vision to Shlomo. Vayomer Elohim, and God famously said to Shlomo, Sha'al ma'etein lach. Ask, what can I give you? Vayomer Shlomo, so Shlomo responds in the dream, Ata sita im avdecha David avi, you did with my father David chesed gadol, a great kindness, kasher halach lefanecha be'emet, in accordance with the fact that he walked with you in peace, ubitzdaka, in righteousness, ubi yishrat levav imach, and he walked upright with you, vatishmor lo et hachesed hagadol hazeh, and you kept your end of the deal, vatitin lo ven yoshev al kiso kayom hazeh, and you made him not just into a singular monarch, but into a dynasty by giving his son a place on the throne. V'ata Adonai Elohai, and now Hashem, my God, ata himlachter avdecha tachat David avi, you have brought me onto the throne of my father David. V'anochi, and what am I, says Shlomo? Okay, this is so different from where he is at the end of his life, when he has his terrible yiridah, one born of arrogance. V'anochi, na'ar katon lo edat seit vavo. Right, the humility, I'm young, I'm inexperienced, I don't know yet the right way to be. Okay, again, this remarkable humility. V'anochi na'ar katon lo edat seit vavo. V'yavdecha b'tocham chasher b'charta, and I find myself amidst the nation that you have chosen, Amrav, a great nation, asher lo yimanev lo yisafer meirov, that's numerous and a multitude. And what do I need? V'natata l'avdecha lev shomeya. This is the term that Rabbi Tversky just loved. The lev shomeya. What do I ask? Not riches, not wealth, not power. But what do I want? A lev shomeya, a discerning heart, a heart which can hear. This is what Ellen was talking about before. So that the gift of silence is not only so that we can grow in our own wisdom, so that we can enrich ourselves. It certainly is that, by the way. We can enrich, that's the whole point that we're trying to stress tonight. You can enrich and exalt ourselves through utilizing silence and listening to others. But what does Shlomo want a lev shomeya for? The capacity to listen? Not so much for himself, but what's the, this is Ellen was saying before, lishpoten amcha lahavin bein tov l'ra, ki mi yuchal lishpoten amcha kaved hazeh. What does Shlomo want a lev shomeya for? What's the telos? What's his objective? Excellent, to be able to help people better, so that he can judge fairly, honestly, and properly. And that's the whole key. I don't want to leave Shomeya just for the sake of accruing my own wisdom. That's important in its own right. But I want a discerning heart, a careful listening ear, a discerning heart, so that I'm better able to get to truth, to justice, to righteousness, so that I'm able to do my job and help the nation of Israel that much better. Eli.
Just a quick question. The word kaved is actually pretty interesting. Does that mean difficult also?
Probably. It's true. Kaved means both numerous and heavy, but...
Kaved is heavy and
it's excellent. That's an excellent idea. Okay. It's not just numerous and heavy, but...
Because it says here...
Schwer.
But, yeah.
Exactly. Difficult. Difficult.
So he knew what
was he was up against. Right, exactly. Exactly. You know, he had been on the job. He hadn't been on the job long, but he'd been on the job long enough to know that. That one didn't take so long to figure out. Okay. Vayitav hadavar b'nei Adonai. So Hashem's response is that this is truly extraordinary, that Shlomo would have asked this. Ki sha'al Shlomo at hadavar hazeh. Vayomer Elohim elav, ya'an asher sha'alta hadavar hazeh. Because you asked for this. Velo sha'alta l'cha yamim rabim. You didn't ask for yourself. You didn't ask longevity. V'lo sha'alta l'cha osher, and you didn't ask wealth and opulence. V'lo sha'alta nefesh o'ivecha, and you didn't ask power and might. V'sha'alta l'cha havin lishmoa mishpat, and you asked to be able to do your job better, which is to judge the nation in righteousness. And for that, you needed a discerning heart. You needed unique wisdom and insight and the ability to listen to that which is presented in front of you as you sit in judgment, to listen with a unique insight, with a uniquely discerning ear, a uniquely hearing heart. Okay? Hinei asiti kidvarecha. So Hashem says, I will grant your request. Hinei natati lecha lev chacham v'navon, a wise and discerning heart, asher kamocha lo haya lefanecha v'acharecha lo yakum kamocha, something that's sui generis, something that's utterly unique, that will never have been before and will never take place after. This is a very important pasuk. It's saying that Shlomo literally was granted something that no mortal, no human being was ever granted before or after. It's a very, very important pasuk. Okay? So that Shlomo's wisdom was truly unique, just as Moshe's prophecy, Moshe's nevuah was sui generis, was completely unique. That's one of the Rambam's Ikari Amuna, one of the principles of the Rambam's faith. So what the Navi is telling you here is that Shlomo's wisdom, his discernment, was a unique gift, something that God bestowed upon one man and one man alone. V'gam asher lo sha'alta, this is the nicest, or nice part, I shouldn't say the nicest part, but this is one of the perks. V'gam asher lo sha'alta natati lach, right, and that which you did not ask, namely might, power, wealth, opulence, all those things that you didn't ask, I'm giving that to you too. Gam osher, gam kavod, asher lo haya chamocha ish bamlachim kol yamecha. Just as your wisdom will be unmatched and unparalleled, so too your prestige, the illustriousness of your kingdom, shall also be unique. V'im telech bidracha lishmor chukai mitzvotai kasher halach David avicha ve'arachti et yamecha. And not only that, but if you continue to follow my ways, then I will grant you arichas yamim as well, and presumably dynastic rule. Now, we obviously know the end of the story. The end of the story is much darker than this, but again, this was more than an auspicious beginning. This was a truly singular event. Okay. So then what happened? The famous story, which Rav Tursky read in such a beautiful way. So as tavona shtayim nashim zonot el hamelech v'atamodna lefanav. At that point, right after Shlomo had been granted what we call the lev shomeya, the hearing heart, the two women come to Shlomo. And I should note here that the Navi stresses that they were just two women, but two women who were zonot, right? That was part of their society also, right? And, The Torah says, Lo yeh kadesh b'vnei Yisrael, Lo yeh kadesh b'vnei Yisrael. There shouldn't be prostitution, male or female prostitution. But again, you know, society was not perfect, even in the times of Shlomo. And l'chora, there were prostitutes. Now, that'll become important detail a little later, because, you know, a person should never be judged. The entirety of a person's character should not be judged based on any one detail, even as important a detail as that might be. The fact that both of these women are prostitutes doesn't strip them of their humanity. And that's very important. That's why I like to stress that detail. So, let's just stop here. So what do we normally think is the way? Let's just fast forward because it's such a famous incident. So how does Shlomo figure out, typically how do we think of this story? How does Shlomo figure out who was the real mom? We know where this is going. We'll read the psukim, but I just, you know. So what did he do? What was his kuntz?
He gave them the option of cutting the baby in half and giving each one half.
Exactly. So that's the way we, exactly, very good. So Rivka, that in other words, the real mother said, of course, with the maternal instinct, you know, on DEFCON 5, you know, the real mother, of course, said, you know, absolutely not. Let the child live. This is my child. I'd rather my child live somewhere else than my child, God forbid, be killed. And the woman who, you know, more than anything else, wanted, you know, was miserable and obviously desperate and just lost a child, and you can imagine what she was going through. You know, her preference was that, right, she was okay with the idea of this other woman's child being taken away because, you know, the only thing that would, in the short term, assuage her immense pain was the idea that she wasn't alone. That, you know, again, she had lost her child, so, you know, again, you know, I don't want to be too harsh about it. You know, obviously she was in a difficult situation also, but that which would assuage her pain was that the idea that the other woman shouldn't have a child either. Okay, that's basically the story, right? So the true maternal instinct kicks in. The one who's not the actual mother is okay with this other woman's child being killed, who she's pretending is her child, because psychologically speaking, at that point what she needs, you know, misery loves company, is that psychologically speaking, she's okay with that. Because she's so devastated herself. Okay, that's the way we typically read the story. But Mavtorsky has a great insight. Okay, let's take a look at the psukim. So as tavona shtayim nashim nezonot al hamelech v'atamod lelefanav v'atomer ha'isha achas. So one of the women says, "Bi Adoni," she says to Shlomo, "Ani v'ha'isha hazot, I and this other woman." We were in one house, and we both delivered around the same time. When I had just delivered for 3 days, meaning 3 days after my little baby was born, this other woman then gave birth. We were the only two people in the house. We were the only two ones in the house. Right, and one of the infants died. Right, this woman is claiming this other woman's infant died. She must have crushed her infant in her sleep. Right, we would call this today. Right, that like some, probably SIDS, you know, is what happened. But again, so the idea was somehow the baby died in the night. This is not something that, unfortunately, is something tragic, but something that's very, very much a part of life. Vatakum b'soch halayla. So this woman, when she realized this is, you know, woman A's story, so she's claiming woman B. You know, when this woman realized that her child was dead, vatakum b'toch halayla vatikachet b'ni me'etzli, she stole my child. Vamatcha yishena, and I was sleeping. Vatashkiveu b'cheka v'et b'na hamet, and she took her dead child. Hishkiva b'cheki, and she switched the child. Okay, that's the story. The story is one of an infant switching. Any questions just on the facts as they're being presented? Okay. So va'akumba boker leheniket b'ni, I got up to nurse my child in the morning, right, which is a miracle in its own right. The child didn't wake, right? She's actually getting up to right, the child's already sleeping through the night. That's historic. At this point, Shlomo could know that she was lying, right? This story doesn't make any sense at all. But anyway, va'akum ba'boker leheniket b'ni, I got up in the morning to nurse my child, v'hinei meit, and I saw that my living child had been replaced with a dead child. V'et bonein alav ba'boker v'hinei lo haya v'ni asher yalati. Then I looked at the child, and a mother can always tell, this was not my baby. V'atomer isha acheres. And at this point, the other woman interjected, the woman who's being accused of a horrible crime. A desperate crime, but a horrible crime nonetheless. So she interjects, lo, it's not so. Ki b'ni ha'chai u'v'nei chameis, my child is living, and hers, your child is dead. V'zos omeres, and the woman who told the story to begin with, she responds, defending her initial version of events, lo, ki b'nei chameis, your child is dead, u'b'ni ha'chai. And my child is the one living. And they continued to speak in front of the king. And Shlomo, with his lev shomea, made the following point. This one says, Zebni hachai uvnei chames, my child lives and your child is dead. Vizosomeres, and the other one says, lo, no, it's not true. Ki b'nei chames, your child is dead. Uvini hachai, and my child is alive. So then the king says, Vayomer hamelech chuli cherev, vayaviu acherev lifnei hamelech, and we know the rest of the story. So Rav Tversky pointed out, why is Shlomo repeating what each of them said? We know what each of them said. But Shlomo picked up on one word, one subtle shift with his lev shomea, just by the power of his actually listening, not just hearing what they said, but listening to what they said, and he had already figured out, long before he ever took out the sword, who the real mother was. Go back to the psukim. What's the difference between the two claims of the women? What is Shlomo when he repeats? What is he repeating? What nuance is he stressing? What's their difference in presentation? Ostensibly, they both have the same claim. My child is alive, the other child is dead. Yeah, Brian.
The order.
Ah, very good. What's the order? Good. Just
the first one.
100% correct. Go ahead.
The first one is the living is first, the dead one. And the second one, the dead one is first, the dead one.
Ah, so what did Shlomo realize? What's the psychological underpinning of those two similar but radically distinct? Yeah, so what did Shlomo realize? He understood the perspective of the actual mother was, more than anything else, my child is alive, my child is alive, I can't lose my child. And it happens to be that your child is also dead. But my child is alive, that was the focus. The other woman, what was her story really all about? What was she after? She was after, right, that's what we said before, tragically, that misery loves company. What she was actually after was, you know, bringing somebody else into her situation. She was okay with the idea of b'nei chames u'b'nei hachai, right? The primary thrust of her story is not my child is alive. She knows her child is not alive. But she'd rather see b'nei chames, she'd rather see that the other woman be in her situation as well. That's exactly what Shlomo's repeating. It's the similar story, but it's completely different. One is saying, b'nei hachai, my child is alive, my child is alive, don't take my child from me. The other one is saying, right, really saying, my child is dead, but I want your child to be dead also. B'nei chames, more than anything else. So that's why Shlomo repeats it. And Shlomo says, that's the key to the case. And then he takes out the sword and he proves it. And that's the rest of the story. So really, Shlomo didn't figure it out with the sword. Shlomo figured it out with the lev shomea. That's exactly what this story is trying to illustrate. Sometimes one word in presentation, if you really listen carefully, can tell you everything you need to know about where a person is coming from. So again, this highlights, I think, in such a classical way, exactly where Mishlei was coming from. And Mishlei said, if you go all the way back to the beginning, again, Mishlei, authored by Shlomo HaMelech, right, who asked, more than anything else, that he asked from Hashem, he asked for a lev shomea, he asked for a heart that could hear, a discerning heart. That's exactly what Shlomo meant when he said, this is just in the first source, Lev Navon Yiknedas Veozen Chachamim Tevakesh Das. The Chacham is characterized by his discerning heart and his listening ear. And that's the key to everything. Because if you have that, if you're willing to really listen, two things will emerge. Number one, a person will be able to grow in their wisdom, be able to gather wisdom from the outside, from people around them, from all kinds of sources. But maybe even more importantly is that after one has accumulated, you know, a certain amount of wisdom, if one's willing to actually listen, one can use that in such a powerful way to listen to people, what Ellie called before active listening, and to respond. What did Shlomo want a lev shomea for, if not to sit and to utilize it in judgment of the Jewish people? Again, I think that these are, there's a certain duality here. Silence being utilized for one's own development, one's own growth in terms of wisdom, exalting one's personality through absorbing and internalizing wisdom, but then also being able to contribute so meaningfully to other people. If one can be silent and use that silence as a time to listen and not just as a time to wait to speak, I think that can be, as illustrated by the story of Shlomo and the two women, just an incredibly powerful way to help people. So listening and using silence to listen really has incredibly beneficial aspects for oneself, but also for one's interactions. And it's that duality which really makes silence such a profound gift. So we'll...